Dennis McCarthy, who interviewed Helga on BBC Radio Nottingham, remembered her and just let her talk with hardly any questions. Unfortunately, the studio didn't record the beginning. Dennis McCarthy asked Helga again how she met Hitler, and the recording starts with that story.
And I stopped and I looked. Well, the road, of course, was empty, but crowds of people standing there, and I thought, if I squeeze through the people and the Hitler youth in the front, I might be able to just run across before Hitler arrives. I did that, but I'm afraid I only got to the middle of the road when he came round the corner. He was standing in an open car. One of the SS men jumped off and he came towards me and he said, oh, you can give those flowers to the Führer. So I said, well, they're really for my father. But of course I couldn't stand in the middle of the road with flowers and be allowed to go to the other side. So he just pulled me along and he said, you give them to the Führer. And Hitler looked down at me and I was really a bit frightened. I was only 14 years old and of course I knew he was a very famous man. He had rather penetrating eyes. And although I didn't intend to give him the flowers, somehow my arm just came up and he took the flowers. And then he looked very sternly at me and he said, you are not in uniform. Because I was Swiss, I hadn't joined the Hitler Youth, and of course I didn't have the uniform, although I was in civilian clothes. So I said, well, I'm not German, I'm Swiss. But I don't think he heard it because people were shouting and screaming, and the SS men just said, look, you can walk to the other side of the road now. But when I came home and I told my father about it, he was rather concerned because he said, I hope nobody's taken a photograph of it and put you in the paper, because it's not a very nice advert for a Swiss girl to give flowers to Hitler. And when I came to school the next day, of course, all the other girls in my class, they all were jealous, because the youth did adore Hitler in those days. And they all teased me and they kept on saying, you don't even belong to the Hitler Youth and you give Hitler some flowers. And I kept on saying, well, they were really for my father, but I don't know whether they believed me or not.
What did you know of Hitler before?
I knew just certain things, like, for example, when he came to power, Jewish people disappeared. We had two Jewish girls in my class, and with one of them I was quite friendly. When she didn't come to school, I decided to find out what happened to her, because nobody would give me a reply. So I went to her house. They had a draper's shop, and they lived above it in a flat. Well, the draper's shop was broken into, and all the gloves and hats and material and haberdashery was all laying in the road. And even upstairs, the flat, the windows were broken. It was gave me rather funny feeling, because although there were other people living along that road, nobody was outside. It was sort of very quiet and eerie. But I did meet a woman, and I said to her, what happened to Ilse? She just said, look, you keep quiet and go home. That was the SS. Don't ask questions. It was a matter of keeping everything sort of on the quiet side. It wasn't talked about. People were afraid to mention it, but the SS would go and do that. We even had a very big store in Königsberg called Stern, and that was Jewish. That was all smashed up suddenly and everything taken away by the SS. But people just didn't ask questions. They accepted it, and then it was forgotten. And that was that.
Now, you said you lived in East Prussia.
Yes.
How did you get there? Because you said you were Swiss.
Yes.
So why were you in East Prussia?
Well, it was already my grandfather who emigrated from Switzerland, and he founded a dairy in a small town called Tilsit by the Lithuanian border. Actually, he's the originator of the Tilsit cheese. You can still buy it today sometimes. And my father took over the dairy. And then we moved to Königsberg because my mother wanted us to have a better education than a small town like Tilsit. And because of that, my father had to travel rather a lot, and he didn't come home until the weekend, particularly when the war started, because of shortage of petrol. So we were Swiss people, but living in Germany, making our living there.
Now, my geography isn't too good. Was East Prussia part of Germany when you first moved there?
Yes, it was divided from the main part of Germany through the Polish corridor. After the last war at the Versailles Treaty, Poland got this part of land because they wanted an outlet to the sea. And they had their harbour, Gdynia, which was next to the port of Gdansk, or Danzig, we used to call it. And if we wanted to travel from East Prussia to the mainland of Germany, we had to go through the Polish corridor. So we were really separate, but we were German up there. The only way you could go without a passport, of course, would be to go along the Baltic by boat. So you had got this division. And this was one of the reasons why the war actually started, because Hitler demanded this Polish corridor back for Germany, because there were a lot of Germans living there. And he made that an excuse of marching into Poland in 1939, and of course with the Russians marching in from the other side, which is very often forgotten. That part of the war was soon finished, and Russia and Germany divided Poland.
Now, you said that Hitler was much admired.
Yes.
Loved in a sense by many of his people. That's difficult to sort of realise now, because we think of Hitler as a monster, as somebody who was terribly evil. He personally was evil. And it's difficult even now to go back almost 60 years and realise that people in Germany, in parts of Germany, really adored this man.
Well, the youth adored him because, as I mentioned before, when they were 10 years old, they had to join the Hitler Youth. And, of course, from that moment on, they were indoctrinated with the love of Hitler. He was going to be the saviour of Germany. Germany suffered very much after the First World War. A lot of land was taken away from them. And, of course, we had inflation, terrible inflation. People had no work. They starved. And Hitler promised them work. And, of course, he did. He started to build the Autobahn. He took the money away from the Jewish people, so he had money, so he could do all sorts of things. And like I said, the children used to meet once a week in Hitler Youth. They had an evening, and at the weekend they used to go to camps. I was lucky, through a friend of mine, I was able to visit twice, actually. I visited them in the evening meeting, and I could see what it was like. They started off by singing marching songs, and then they all had to learn the different curriculum vitae of Hitler, Himmler, Goebbels and Goering. That was really drummed into them. And then, like I said, Hitler was portrayed as the father, and they loved him. And when he came to the towns to make these speeches, the Hitler Youth was there, and he mingled amongst them, and he shook hands with them. So when these young boys of 10 were 17, 18, they went very, very willingly into the war. They died for this man because he was always portrayed as such a kind man. I like also to point out that we had no crime amongst the youth because they were all occupied. Already in those days, they used to collect tins and paper and aluminium from the Swedes, all the sort of aluminium paper. And all the Hitler Youth were organized. They had to go and help old people, do shopping for them, do some gardening for them. So they never really had a lot of free time. Because of that, we had no crime. You just had to do that. I had a lot of free time, and I was rather keen on reading, so I could fill it with that, and I did a lot of sport. I belonged to a private sports club. But when I was young, I always felt I wanted to join my school friends, because they used to tell me what they've done at the weekend when they went camping and things like that. It was all quite pleasurable, a lot of it. They were never told that they must go and kill Jews or anything like that. That was avoided, that talk. And I must also say that I never knew about concentration camps. I don't know whether my father did. Being older, he probably didn't want to worry us, but I personally never knew about it until the end of the war. But what we did know about was when the war against Russia started, that the Russians wouldn't treat the civilian population the same way as the Western powers would. So once the war against Russia started, we got a bit concerned. And particularly after the Battle of Stalingrad in 1943, that's when things turned and the Germans gradually got pushed back. And we in the East, now we started to get worried.
Well, I'd like to talk about that. But when the war first started in 1939, you were a teenager.
Yes.
What was the immediate effect of war in 1939 in the part of Germany in which you lived?
Well, we noticed already before it started that something would happen, because Königsberg, being the capital of East Prussia, was suddenly full of soldiers and army equipment, and there was a lot of whispers going around, you know, this is war, you see, and some people wanted, didn't, others didn't. My mother didn't, she remembered the First World War. But the young people, let's say sort of 1920, of course, they were, oh yes, we're all going into the war, and particularly the Air Force, they all wanted to go in the Air Force. And it wasn't bad when it started, because although we had food rationing, it was still very generous. And of course, this first part of the war against Poland, they called it the Blitzkrieg, I mean, a lightning war, it was finished quite quickly. And then we thought this would be the end of it, but of course it wasn't, because then the next thing was France. And of course, eventually Hitler occupied more or less all of Europe, didn't he? I mean, he even took Denmark, he even went into Norway, and then in the south there was all the other countries, Greece, Romania, Hungary. I mean, that was all occupied by Hitler. And the men disappeared. We had no more men suddenly. There were only women and a lot of foreign workers. The SS would just go to Poland and bring foreign workers back. They just go and collect women and men, and they had to come back to Germany and to East Prussia to work in factories. Or, for example, my mother had a very big house and we had no domestic help, which was difficult because she had four children. So we were allowed to have a Polish girl to work for us. Well, some of them came from very primitive backgrounds. I remember one girl, when my mother showed her how the toilet worked, she pulled the chain. The poor girl was absolutely petrified. She thought it was a ghost or so, and she ran out and she ran away. We never saw her again. She was petrified.
Now, towards the end of the war, how did you know that Germany was doing badly?
Well, I was a medical student, and when Königsberg got severely bombed by the English, the anatomy was bombed, the university, I had to give up my studies and only work in the military hospital. Well, with that, I got contact with the wounded that came back, and we heard the truth. Because, you see, on the radio, Hitler never admitted that the German troops retreated. He'd had taken over. I mean, he was the great commander of the whole German army. But the wounded soldiers told us, and towards the end, 44-45, they even warned us that they were quite close to Königsberg. And they also had conquered back villages which had been occupied by the Russians. And they said to us young nurses, you know, you ought to try and get away, because the way they are treating the civilian population is absolutely terrible. So I did leave in January 45. I just had to, because I was on station duty very often, and some of these wounded soldiers that came back, they were only laying in cattle trucks on a little bit of straw, and we had 10 to 15 degrees below zero. And it was one of my jobs to sort the dead from the ones that were still alive. I was only 20 years old. But when I saw that, I knew they hadn't come very far. And when they warned us, I thought I must go. It was very unfortunate that at a particular moment the whole family was actually scattered, because we hadn't heard from my father from Tilsit. We already thought he was dead, because we realized the Russians must have come as far as that already. My brother was evacuated, and one of my sisters was in the south of Germany. But I was always going to go with my other sister who worked for the Red Cross, but somehow we didn't get together. So I just left and went and joined a refugee track, and we just walked.
Did you meet up with your family later?
I did in the end, yes. We were very fortunate that after it was all over, we did find ourselves when the war was finished, and we lived in a radio station, a smashed up radio station in one of the barracks there, because we didn't want to go into a refugee camp. We had a well in the front of the hut, and there was a tiny little hut in the back with a bucket and a board on the top, and that was our toilet. But we did all get together, because after the war I travelled by bike all the way down to the south of Germany to find my sister, who was married there. She was expecting a baby. Her husband had been taken away 2 or 3 days before the end of the war by the SS. She never heard of him again. She was a widow before a child was born. I brought her back to this radio station, and she had the baby in those very primitive circumstances. There was no post, there was no train after the war in Germany. Trains only ran for the occupation forces and for food and necessary equipment, but not for civilians.
Did you find your father?
Yes. Yes, I found my father, actually, like a miracle in Hamburg. He was queuing up to sign his name in at the Red Cross. You could go and queue up at Red Cross stations to put your name down, and they would try and find the rest of the family. That's how I found my father. I found my mother already in Greifswald. That was when I finished my refugee track. I was very ill. I mean, I had 6 weeks where I never had a bath, or they had to burn my clothes and cut my hair. And I was ill for a long time because I just couldn't keep any food. I'd starved too long, because we only lived, well, we just ate the bark of the tree. But I found my mother there. I wasn't going to stay in Greifswald because the war wasn't finished, and I was so frightened of the Russians that we tried to get to Hamburg, but we never did get as far as that, because the lorry we were in was shot at by Spitfires. But we were able to jump off. And I finished up at the farm with my mother. But during the war, we were always forced in the summer holiday to work on farms. Even, you know, the school had you didn't get school holiday, you just had to go and help on the farm. And luckily enough, I'd learned how to milk cows. So when we got shot at with this lorry and we called in at the nearby farm, the woman there had her arm in plaster. And when I said I could milk cows, she said, "Oh, you're a godsend." And she kept us, although we had to sleep in the hayloft, but at least we got food, and we stayed there until the war was finished. And then I found my father, like I said, in Hamburg. And I travelled all the way down on a broken bike to Mainburg to try and find my sister in the south of Germany. That was another journey. The war was already finished. But the trouble was, the roads were full of people who were trying to get back. There were Hungarians who wanted to get back to Hungary, and the Czechoslovakians, they wanted to get back to Czechoslovakia, and the Poles, and concentration camps and prisons were opened, and not everybody who was imprisoned was innocent. So it was really quite a dangerous journey to do as a young girl. But I was lucky. I occasionally got a lift, and I slept on farms and in haystacks. I even got imprisoned by the Americans because I was on the road after curfew. But that wasn't so bad, because I met an American sergeant with beautiful brown eyes. I've never forgotten him. I think I fell in love a little bit, and he helped me a lot. He gave me some food, and he mended my bike.
Why was there this great fear of the Russians?
First of all, they never belonged to the Geneva Convention, and the Russians were treated very, very badly by the Germans. I saw Russian prisoners of war marching along the road. I mean, they only had rags around their feet and sort of a coat on and a bit of string round. The Germans treated them very badly, and I think this was their revenge. We knew There was no rule. The Russians had not been told how they ought to treat civilians. It depended which type of Russians entered the particular part where you lived. But in my first book, I wrote under the chapter The Village of Hell, and I described a village we went through as refugees where the Russians had been. And what I saw there for weeks after that, I used to wake up at night frightened what they had done to the people there. They raped not only young girls, any woman. They slit their clothes open. And they were just laying there in the frost. There's a lot. I have only told a little bit, but it was shocking. And I knew why everybody left. You see, in the West, nobody left. When the English and Americans came, I think a lot of Germans were glad, thank God the war is finished, and that is that. They didn't lose their homes. But we knew what the Russians were like. The soldiers had told us, and it was quite true. I mean, we've got the same today in Yugoslavia, haven't we? The way the civilian population is treated there. I don't know what it is. It seems to be a different race of people. They've got no regard for life. It doesn't matter to them. It's their reward. And they take everything. And if they couldn't get a ring off a woman's hand, they just cut the finger off or the hand off, and they just take it. And I'm not telling lies. I've seen it.
You became a refugee to get away from the Russians, and we've seen pictures of long lines of refugees leaving a country trying to find peace somewhere. But what's it really like? Because presumably you leave your house or you leave your accommodation. You can only take a certain amount with you, that you can carry. So the bulk of the things that you own, that you take for granted that you own, tables, chairs, beds, furniture, anything at all, you leave that behind. And when you leave that behind to become a refugee, you don't know how long it is before you'll be back, if you ever are going to come back. So are you resigned to leaving everything behind and trying to find a new life?
Well, when I left, I don't think I realised that I wouldn't come back. I sort of hoped that maybe the German army would push the Russians back again. I remember when I left the house, I locked the front door, and, you know, I took the key towards the back. We had a little hiding place, and I hid that key there so that if I come back, I would have the key to get in again. I didn't realise that we would never come back. I just took warm clothes because it was 10 to 15 degrees below zero, and I had a suitcase which I put on top of a sleigh because, I mean, it was no good having anything else except a sleigh, and I had a rucksack. I took all the money with me I've had, and particularly you wanted something to bargain for, and that was maybe some brandy and some cigarettes, because for that you could exchange that probably for food. I lost my suitcase in the end because we had to cross what was called the Huff, which was... it's like a frozen lake because the Russians gradually surrounded us, and we came to a small strip of land which we used to call the Neung, and that's where we had to walk along. But when we crossed the Huff, we had the farmers with us who had horses and carts, of course, and when the Russians realized that there was a big track, they knew we were civilians, they just shot at us. And of course, if the ice breaks, horses and carts just disappear, and it's no good trying to help them. But you don't think anymore then about your house. You just think only about first the next day, then about the next hour. And in the end, you just only think about the next step you're going to do, because, well, if you dropped, you were dead, because nobody lifted you up again. And it didn't take long before you were frozen stiff. And they were just... people were just laying there.
With the war over, when did life become normal, if you can ever use that word with you? When did it become normal for you?
Well, we registered with the Swiss embassy because my father had lost his passport, or I don't know where he's lost it, actually. I don't think he had it on him when he had to leave. And they promised to transport us back to Switzerland. because we decided there was no point in starting again in Germany. We couldn't go back because that was now occupied by the Russians. And if we had to start, we might as well start in a country that had been neutral and wasn't in a war. And they promised us to help us when we come back to Switzerland. So the following year, we moved from this radio station and we got transport back to Switzerland. And that's the story of my second book, how we got back to Switzerland and started again in Switzerland.
And did you start with nothing?
With nothing, because even the clothes I had on had been given to me because they had burned my clothes because they were, well, it was impossible to keep them. We started with nothing. When we arrived in Switzerland, I think that was something which was a great shock to us, because we had to go into quarantine and we didn't realize what quarantine meant. I've never been locked up, and this was the first time in my life that I was locked up. We went through a gate, and that gate was closed, and there was a fence round. We were separated, men, women, and children. We had to strip naked, and we were examined by a doctor. You see, the Swiss are very clean. They're very particular. They were afraid we could bring a disease back. Well, I understand that, but it could have been done a little bit more humane, because we'd all had suffered rather a lot, and this wasn't exactly the right thing to do. And we were supposed to have 3 weeks in quarantine, because in 3 weeks they hoped any disease would show. I was fortunate with my younger sister that we got out earlier, because they suddenly said, are there any people who have got medical or nursing experience? And because I had studied medicine and, of course, nursed wounded soldiers, we came forward. So they sent us to Gstaad, a beautiful place in the mountain, and to help with a new children's home. When we arrived, we discovered all they wanted was a domestic help. We had to scrub floors and walls in order to get this home ready for the children. But after that, they told me that I could not study medicine anymore because there was no money. My father had no job. It was difficult for him to find a job because, you see, Switzerland makes cheese and butter. That is their trade. And this is why my father had his dairy in East Prussia, really. So they said to me I could have a six-month course in commercial college. I could learn shorthand and typing and then maybe go into an office, which I did. I didn't like the office after that. So I went to the hotel trade, and at a small hotel near Lucerne in Hergerswil, I met my future husband. But he only came as a visitor. He went home and he told his parents that he met a Swiss girl and he was getting married to her. But he hadn't told me. Mm-hmm. And in order to come over to England, which I intended to do because I felt if I stayed in the hotel trade, I would have to learn English. I came over to England as an au pair girl and worked in a children's home in Hemel Hempstead, which wasn't very far from where my husband lived. Well, a year later, we got married. But then I thought, now at last, this will be peace and happiness. But I'm afraid it wasn't, because my eldest son, when he was born, had cerebral palsy. And I sometimes wonder whether everything I went through when I was young was a preparation for this accident of birth, because his cerebral palsy is not inherited, it's just an accident. He was a small little baby, only weighed 3¾ pounds when he was born. But when he was 18 months old, I told me he would never walk and never talk, and I should put him into a home. Well, I've always been like that. If somebody told me, you can't do that, it used to get my back up. And when they told me that this little baby would have to go into a home, I thought, right, I'm not going to let him go into home. I could see there was some intelligence there, and I was determined to to do something about it. In those days it was very difficult because they called them spastics and all sorts of names, and of course he didn't talk until he was four. So of course he must be stupid too. But no, I did find a physiotherapist who taught me how to teach Victor to move his limbs. She said, cerebral palsy is a brain damage. The part of the brain that controlled Victor's legs was damaged. And she said, the rest of the brain we will teach. We will teach the rest of the brain to take over so that he can move his legs.
Now, you had a cerebral palsy child.
Yes.
You had some fairly hideous experiences on what you saw and all that happened to you. Do you feel bitter at all that life hasn't been fair to you?
No, I don't think I ever felt bitter. I think the reason why I never felt bitter was I never had time for it. I always had to get on. Because not only I had two sons, I had another son, but he was all right. I had a very good husband. He'd always backed me and helped me and did a lot for Victor to that we gradually got him walking. He didn't only walk, he even went to school, he learned to read and write. He even qualified himself, and I can say that today he's a computer expert. Now that is something which I'm proud of, because I feel it's partly because I wouldn't give in. I pushed him. You know, he was late, and people didn't realize that he was late in his development. And I feel today that I found a new background, a new home in England. And both my children are married now. I feel it's fine. I've got through it. And I only hope that other people who have handicapped children don't give up, you know, do the same as I do, just go to the authorities and ask them for it. You find a lot of people help you if you go yourself and you push and you ask. There are lots of kind people about. I've always found that in the end. Maybe I pushed too much, but still, they always did help me.
You were bombed by the British.
Yes.
When you were in the refugee convoy, you were gunned by a British Spitfire. How do you feel about the British?
I never felt bad about the British, actually. And, you know, even in Germany, the British were always admired, even during the war. I don't feel bitter that they bombed me, because the thing was, I was in a lorry which looked like an army lorry, and a Spitfire high up there, seeing that, that was his job to do. And quite honestly, when I came to England, I was, as an au pair girl, I was happier there than I was in Switzerland, because in Switzerland I was regarded as ein Rückwanderer, that's what they called us. I was an emigrant that had returned. And we gave ourselves away, because although we spoke German, we didn't speak the Swiss dialect. So even when I went in the shop, people used to recognize us straight away. And they didn't understand us. They never had a war.
You can read the story of Helga in Helga, The Continuing Story by Helga Gerhardy. And it's published by Verona at £7.99. Helga, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.